Hello and welcome to the Brewin podcast. This week's conversation is a global macro debate where our guest, Caroline Miller of BCA Research, explains why BCA Research are downgrading their outlook for equities. But I wouldn't want our listeners to get too nervous, as our guest now explains.
We feel it would be premature to go into bunker mode.
Okay, so a reassuring line there, but for some more colour and detail on what is essentially a balanced view, please keep listening. I assure you it's well worth 20 minutes and full and clear details on the global macro outlook. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're going to be having a global macro conversation with Caroline Miller of at BCA. Caroline joined BCA in 2012 as a chief strategist and a member of the research team, and still contributes to that research team today. But her role has sort of evolved as we see it, as almost sort of a chief communicator, bringing together all the different parts at BCA Research and helping to communicate and the clients understand the house view. And it is because of those superior communication skills that we've asked Caroline to be on our podcast today from her office in Montreal. We are the thread of the conversation is going to begin by discussing BCA's recent downgrade of equities to neutral, from an overweight to neutral. And then I thought we'd talk about the dollar. It does seem that is an all-important conversation, given its impact on emerging markets, but also, of course, generally most asset classes at large. So once again, Caroline, thanks so much for joining us. As I said, you've downgraded equities to neutral very recently. You may first want to let us know the positive elements as to why you're not going underweight, but then pad that out by letting us know why you've downgraded.
Sure. Thanks for your time. Yes, so on June 20th, we put out a fairly extensive communicated clients, just sort of putting a line in the sand and acknowledging that our multi-year view that risk assets and global equities in general were going to offer better total return prospects than cash and bonds, that we've lost enthusiasm for that view. Quickly, why we haven't gone to outright underweight, we acknowledge that global growth is still above trend. In particular, in the U.S., which is half of the global equity market, global growth is meaningfully above trend and continuing to accelerate as a result of the, I don't think there's a better way to describe it other than a sugar hit to aggregate demand coming from fiscal stimulus in the U.S. That is a thrust we're not seeing as much of elsewhere, but we still see above trend growth in the euro area. And we see, we've seen a recovery in oil prices. We see global capital spending is still growing. And we see that overall monetary conditions are not that restrictive. And that is really what is fueling still a pretty propitious outlook for global earnings and global profit margins. And so for this reason, we feel it would be premature to go into bunker mode. Another reason not to go underweight is that there'll be a certain point in the cycle, excuse me, where we think it makes sense to get more defensive and upgrade fixed income, but we're not there yet because we still see inflation recovering, and thus we see upside for nominal yield. So why have we moved to neutral? Well, if you follow BCA, you will recall that at the beginning of the year, the theme of our annual outlook piece was markets on a collision course with policy. And I think that's really a critical feature of the macro outlook right now that we're seeing, is that whether you're looking at risk from protectionism, so trade policy, or really a tectonic shift in the relationship between monetary and fiscal policy, those are really driving a shift in our outlook. So let me explain that. Well, I think the concern about the risk that protectionism and tariffs downgrades global trade in general and thus global growth is fairly self-explanatory. It's hard to quantify, but to our mind, if you look at valuation in global equities and the long-term bottom-up earnings growth expectations, particularly in the U.S., which I think is around 16% now, to us that does not seem to take account of some of these risks. So there's a long-term extrapolation of the current thrust of profit margins, which we think have peaked. But in terms of the interplay between monetary and fiscal policy, if you think about the relationship between those two levers as gears toward, you know, changing the trajectory of global growth, since the crisis, you've had until recently very tight fiscal policy, and that has required emergency level, rock bottom in some places, obviously negative interest rates to support growth, fight deflation, and reboot the economy, et cetera. We are now in the 10th year of the expansion of this business cycle, and we see that a lot of the slack that constituted the global output gap, which allowed for above-trend growth without any inflationary pressure, we see that a lot of that slack has now been absorbed. And you can see that by the declining unemployment rates in you know, much of the developed world. And so as a result, it seems it's pretty clear, and I think central banks are around the world are starting to articulate the fact, whether it's the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, even the Fed, the ECB, that this emergency level monetary policy is no longer necessary. And so you're seeing a clear shift away from quantitative easing towards a normalization of policy. And we think that that is going to continue. We see that monetary policy has gone from being exceptionally loose to neutral to still slightly loose in some cases. But we're really on the precipice of a shift as a result of growth being above trend to a need in the next, we would say, 9 to 12 months for outright restrictive policy. And part of that is the shift that we've seen in fiscal policy, which has gone from very tight to, with the extreme example of the U.S., very loose. And we think this is also going to, exacerbate the recovery in inflation. And this is important because, you know, wage growth has been fairly benign to date. And we think that the Phillips curve is very much alive, and you move to the steep slope of the Phillips curve. In other words, the relationship, the more pronounced relationship between the a low unemployment rate and a revival of wage growth and inflationary pressure occurs at these levels of low unemployment where there's capacity constraints. So what I'm basically saying is the global economy is running out of spare capacity, and as a result, we see inflationary pressure likely to lead to the need for more restrictive monetary policy, and we no longer see what have been known as central bank puts. So whether you're looking at the Fed, or the ECB, for example, there's been this Pavlovian response to volatility in markets in recent years, whereby central bank forward guidance kind of mollifies markets anytime you get an air pocket, such that the expectation is the response to volatility, either in growth or markets, will be an extension of easy monetary policy. We think basically that the underwritten insurance for markets has been downgraded, and that central banks now have to be focused on achieving the price stability part of their mandates. And so we see the big support for monetary policy for multiple expansion receding, and we don't think that a lot of the asymmetry in the potential for an air pocket in equities is priced in. What we see is valuations really reflecting the current weather, i.e. the very strong earnings growth, and we think that may have peaked because we see tight labor markets leading to more wage growth at a time when corporate pricing power has recovered, but we see the margin picture at, you know, over the next 9 to 12 months perhaps starting to reflect the more late cycle dynamics. So that in a nutshell is why we've gotten moved to a more neutral setting on global equities. I would point out that one of the potential risks to equities is higher bond yields, and that's why we have yet to, we still recommend an underweight interest rate duration position, but we think that investors should be comfortable accumulating some cash at current levels.
Okay, well, Carol, I mean, that's a really thorough opener. It almost leaves no room for questions, such as the thoroughness of that answer. But if we can revert quickly back to trade and obviously bringing in the geopolitical angle that BCA do such a good job at, I mean, these are one of the things that presumably are extremely hard to predict, but given the unpredictable nature of some of the characters involved, yet for what we do know of the piecemeal of Trump's ideology is he's not really a free marketeer or a free trader, and you've already sort of stated you think markets are complacent to this trade issue. Presumably, you think this has could yet get more divisive and get to really threaten markets much more.
What I really think is that it's very hard. I think one of Trump's one of the elements of his style and negotiating tactics that is consistent is his inconsistency. It is one tactic to manage adversaries is to make it impossible for them to telegraph your movements and thus devise a plan. And I think if you read the communique from several of the central banks, they have a tremendous desire to calibrate the potential, you know, think about BCA is based in Canada, and, you know, we're very close to the central bank governor here. He used to work at BCA, and I've had several conversations with him where he's, you know, we're not going to put tweaks into our growth model and assign numbers to the potential impact, for example, of an abrogation of the North American Free Trade Agreement that are just out of thin air or you know, have been tweeted in the moment. So it's the lack of a tangible expectation for what the terms of trade will be that makes it hard to forecast. So I'm saying that I think for now the attitude has been let's focus on the macro variables that we know for sure and can analyze. And I think there's just this cloud of uncertainty that that is a ubiquitous headwind to growth, and as strong as you know in the investment capex upswing is, it would be stronger but for this uncertainty. I don't personally have any reason to have a high information ratio, if you will, around the outcome, except to say that if you were to outline all the potential sources of geopolitical and trade risk looming over the economy, you would not you would have a difficult time to line that up with current valuation and confidence in equities. That's all I'm saying. I think that there are a number of ways in which a trade war can, you know, can do a lot of damage to risk appetite. And without knowing exactly what path is going to happen, it seems to us that the risk is asymmetric relative to what's discounted.
Okay, fine. And then if we move to the second part of the of your more cautious view, this sort of conflict between monetary policy and fiscal policy, I guess really sort of referring to monetary policy, be interested to know where you see the markets, how are markets pricing the number of interest rate hikes, and really sort of thinking in the question that we've often seen the markets you know, overestimate the amount of rate hikes that are delivered, and this time you would believe that they will deliver on it on the basis that inflation is back. Is that sort of fair to say?
I think it's market specific. So for the UK, we believe that that expectations are too hawkish. We have a hard time imagining that the Bank of England will be able to deliver you know, two more rate hikes in the coming 12 months, given that we see that despite the depreciation in sterling, the outlook for capital spending, manufacturing, and foreign direct investment is still pretty tepid because of the uncertainty around Brexit. So that would be one market where we would be fading what is discounted in terms of rate hikes. I think the opposite is true in the U.S. We believe that the Federal Reserve is currently defining gradual tightening as a quarter of a percentage point every quarter. And that is not what is discounted into the U.S. money market. In fact, there are only three rate hikes priced in over the next 24 months. So to us, the bar for the Fed doing more than markets expect is pretty low. I think in the ECB's case, the challenge is the distinction between the threshold, the growth and profit threshold for the ECB to be comfortable fully retreating from QE, and I think we could argue that threshold has been met, as distinct from the confidence that they will need to have in growth to hike rates. And what is currently discounted is, I think, a move sometime in early 2020, and I think that may be about fair. We don't see the ECB or the Bank of England or the Bank of Japan, for that matter, with inflation still so low there, being able to keep pace with what we think will be the need for a more aggressive Fed, which is, I think, challenged by not only uncertainty around trade policy, but uncertainty around the impact of fiscal stimulus on inflation. So, again, asymmetric risk to the upside for the Fed. And that is what's behind, you asked about the dollar. That's why we see cyclical upside for the dollar. So between now and the end of the Fed tightening cycle, we don't believe that the real short rate differential between the U.S. and other markets has peaked. But structurally, I think the long-term erosion of the fiscal profile of the U.S. is bearish for the dollar. Relative productivity trends are bearish for the dollar. And so over a 2 to 3 year horizon, we are not dollar bulls. But I would say over a 6 to 12 month horizon, as we see the Fed needing to do more, not less, we see some modest upside for the U.S. dollar. And I think that might be most pronounced based on, you know, valuation and general macro fundamentals. The dollar may have more room to move higher versus emerging market and commodity geared, the real pro-cyclical currencies, more so than the euro and the yen, which are not expensive and where the balance of payments is positive. So,
in danger of I don't want to be in danger of of getting you to repeat yourself, but there's some interesting interesting debate in there. Is what the market's paying most attention to? You talked about short rates versus this sugar hit, this tremendous fiscal stimulus, and the pressure that places on deficits, both budget deficits and current account deficits. That, you know, is asking international investors, I guess, to stump up a lot of to provide a lot of funding. And so we just sort of, you've laid down something of a time frame there, but at what point do you expect the markets to defer its attention back to the funding issues?
I would expect that once the market begins to sniff out the end of the Fed tightening cycle, that attention will shift to the long-term erosion of the U.S. fiscal profile.
And the end of the U.S. The end of the monetary tightening cycle is sort of 12, 18 months, is it?
I would say it is second half of next year, yes.
And on the basis that you are dollar bulls over the next 12 months, what impact is that having? And I guess maybe you want to quantify how bullish you are the dollar, whether that's just sort of a modest appreciation or something more sizable. And then how is that view leading into other your view on other asset classes? Of course, emerging markets tend to stand out when you talk about the dollar.
Yes. So the dollar is certainly a counter-cyclical indicator for emerging market financial conditions. To quantify the likely, I think our assumption is you could see the dollar trade in a 110 to 115 range versus the euro, and it could weaken as much as to 120 versus the yen, where we don't see tremendous upside. I think there's more upside versus the EM complex, particularly if China's preferred indemnity against trade wars is a weaker yuan. There's been a lot of ink spilled in the press lately about the recent depreciation in the yuan, but I want to point out that it is still higher in trade-weighted terms than where it was last year at this time. So I think that the Chinese renminbi, you know, could have some more downside, and that, of course, is a critical anchor for all of the suppliers to China, and the terms of which drive import volumes. So, and the other impact on emerging markets is that, of course, we've seen this tremendous buildup of leverage in the emerging world, in the non-financial corporate sector, and this is not just, you know, I hear the argument often, well, the emerging markets are borrowing more in their own currencies, so they're not sensitive to the dollar. That isn't our view. Our view is that a stronger dollar that puts pressure on emerging market currencies requires them to raise local bond yields to protect access to capital, and that tightens financial conditions. And that's the mechanism through which that we worry that the EM complex of risk assets is vulnerable. So whether you're looking at emerging market debt denominated in dollars, where the translation effect of an increasing debt burden via a stronger dollar is direct, or whether it's indirect via a tightening of financial settings in local currency as a result of capital flight, both of those roads lead to some strong headwinds for the outlook for EM risk assets. And I think that it's a function partly of the discrete Fed policy that will be responding to a normalization of U.S. core inflation, and it's partly a function of what China's doing to protect its economy from an export shock.
Okay, and we are, our vast majority of our listeners are sterling-based investors, and you talked briefly about the Bank of England and how you don't believe it will be able to execute and what the market's anticipation is of two rate hikes over the next 12 months. Does that feed into a more cautious view on sterling? I mean, if sterling's going to be one of the weaker currencies, you know, our listeners should be thinking, I guess, more about putting money to work in international assets.
All I would say about sterling, I mean, there's such a, you know, there are so many fairly binary decision trees, but I think it's telling that you've had a meaningful depreciation in sterling, and Britain still running a current account deficit of 4%, which would suggest that its dependence on foreign capital has not been brought to balance even by the current level of the pound. So I would say that I think to the extent that this uncertainty lingers, it's hard to find a catalyst for a more bullish outlook on sterling in the near term. I think you'd need to see a pretty big shift in the negotiation that leads to certainty around the terms of exit to see a big rally in sterling. And I don't have any visibility on that at the moment. I continue to believe that the EU has more leverage in this situation than Britain.
Well, so, I mean, you're not. I mean, that's a very fair answer in the face of a lot of uncertainties, and I don't think anyone, even within the cabinet, has great visibility on what the next move is. But thank you very much. Just to round out the conversation, I remember reading in one of your pieces that you have moved neutral on equities, but that still means it doesn't necessarily mean you think that would be, obviously by implication that it's neutral, it would be the worst performing asset class. But you actually think it could still be the best performing asset class. I mean, neutral weighting is presumably a larger weighting relative to other asset classes in your suite.
Yes, I think we just wanted to communicate that we think the risk, i.e. volatility adjusted upside to equities from current levels is less appealing than it has been at any time since the crisis. That's what we wanted to communicate.
Okay, well, you have done. So thank you very much for neatly rounding that that out. And indeed, all of your contributions have been really, really helpful and really insightful and, you know, gives us a lot of food for thought. So thanks very much, Caroline, for joining us at BCA. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Bruin Podcast. Leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. But until next time, many thanks for listening. Thank you.